So we're continuing with our theme, Path with Heart, and it's going on an interesting path. It's kind of taking on its own little path, and last week we talked about self-love, radical self-acceptance or self-love, and the centrality of that to the practice. And really not something that's addressed as being central to liberation. It's often talked about as a really nice thing to do, right? It's nice to like yourself, and and it's often even equated with self-esteem, which is different than, as we talked about, different than self-esteem. But it's often just seen that, it's something good to do to be happy. But it's much more than that in this practice. In fact, it's got everything to do with freedom and liberation, and not just this, a feel-good kind of happiness. And I hope I made that point, the centrality of this radical self-acceptance. And the manner I was speaking about it was spiritual, not psychological. I think there's a key difference there. It wasn't a Psych 101 talk about self-acceptance or self-esteem. It was a very much a spiritual discussion. And I pointed out the fact that we all are manifestations of freedom or the divine or the non-dual. So any part of ourselves that we reject is a rejection of that ultimate reality, of the non-dual reality. So if we reject any aspect of ourselves or others, I mean, any rejection of aspects we see in others is a projection, something we're rejecting in ourselves, then we are rejecting ultimate reality, the ultimate truth. And it can't be realized. So that's why I say it's central to liberation. It also makes it maybe easier to sleep at night and all those things, because you're not ruminating about something you did yesterday and how, blah, blah, blah. But ultimately, what I was getting at was the centrality that it is, how central it is to liberation or freedom. So this kind of total self-love is really a key part of really, I'm starting to see it as kind of the first step in the practice. And I this quote from the Buddha is, people have heard it before. It's one of the most quoted quotes. I think it's on our website, actually, for this group. You can search throughout the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself. And that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. So I want to kind of take it a step further. Because whenever I offer that teaching about self-love or radical self-acceptance, there's a struggle with it, like accepting myself just the way I am. But what about all the self-improvement projects? And what about, things that I do that I don't want to do, and ways that I want to be that I'm not? And all, what do I just give up on that and just, be a jerk? whatever the story you might have. So I want to sort of come at this at another angle in terms of emptiness. And so I'm entitling this talk, Self-Love and Emptiness. And I did send out an email saying we're going to talk about the Lojong trainings. And this is what I'll follow along. It's book by Norman Fisher, Training in Compassion, Zen Teachings on the Practice of Lojong. What I'm doing, as I'm backing up a little bit, as I started to, two reasons why I'm backing up. One is I wanted to really link self-love to emptiness as a basis for this training. And two, as I started to develop or build a talk, I realized that what I want to do is actually practice this, the slogans in the Lojong trainings. There's a number of slogans before I offer the talks. So it wasn't coming alive. I was kind of like, okay, I've done this a long time ago, but what I'd like to do is do it and then give the talk. And then you can do the practice of week by week. So that's another reason why I'm backing up a little bit. So self-love's the first realization. What's the foundation realization? What's the basis of that? And what I came to in reflecting on this was that our own emptiness or voidness is the basis for that. The fact that we look at ourselves and we find nothing permanent, independent. Now, those may sound like completely different. In fact, I typed in love and emptiness into Google, and I actually got an article in the Shambhala Sun about love and emptiness. So it's not something we see as connected, but I want to try and connect them. Because if we believe we're not whole just as we are, then we're not seeing ourselves as empty. We're not seeing selflessness. We're seeing there's an essence there that needs to be changed. If we're not seeing ourselves as empty of an essence, or an enduring quality, then we see qualities that need to be perfected. So the basis of emptiness is this acceptance of what's arising moment to moment as our manifestation in the world, as life living as us. That's what it really is life living as us. So we're rejecting life when we reject that part of us. So that's where I'm seeing not self, selflessness, egolessness, emptiness. They're all synonymous as the basis for this self-love. Now, at the same time, we have to be careful that we don't lose the conduct in the view, so that we don't see our deeds or actions in the world as important. That's what's called losing conduct in the view. We can learn from what we do in the world, from mistakes that we make. So it's not like we do something that hurts somebody and we just go, well, that's just the life living through me and to hell with you. you go, okay, yeah, that was unskillful. I mean, this is where skillfulness and wholesome acts come in, and you can reflect and go, okay, this is a behavior that would not be harmful. Recognizing at the same time that there's no doer and there's nothing being done. That may sound really kind of woo, but recognizing the emptiness of that at the same time. So we're living, allowing life to live as us. But part of that is a dance. We talked about the dance with life when we did the Four Noble Truths. So we do observe our speech, action, deeds, and we do strive for wholesome speech, action, and deeds. As part of this, recognizing again that there's no doer. That's what's arising in the moment, is an observation of speech, action, and deeds. Another quote from the Buddha, things are not what they seem, nor are they otherwise. Deeds exist, but no doer can be found. Kind of just sums up what I've been going on about in one pithy sentence. Things are not what they seem, nor are they otherwise. Deeds exist, but no doer can be found. One thing Matthew, my teacher, points out to me quite continuously, I must say, is he'll just ask, are you attached to the outcome of this? So part of this is letting go an attachment to the outcome. I still work and, my personality manifests as engaging in certain activities in the world, and that's how life is living as Stephen. But there's no, is there an attachment to the outcome? Because if there's an attachment to the outcome, there's a self in there that's then doing these things in the world. So that's a question I ask myself often now, is am I attached to the outcome? Doesn't mean I don't prepare. I prepare a talk. I do the best that I can. And then I let life unfold. And so this is what the notion of emptiness is really pointing to. So as we get into the Lojong trainings, there's a half a dozen books on this. More than that. I have a half a dozen books, but there's probably many more than that. And what struck me is how different they were in some regards. I mean, the core is the same, but the little nuanced in their approach. So within Lojong, there's relative bodhicitta and absolute bodhicitta. And relative bodhicitta is doing wholesome, helping people in the world in practical ways. It's doing wholesome deeds. I always call this aligning our lives with ultimate reality at the same time. So that's what relative bodhicitta is, doing good works in the world. Absolute bodhicitta is absolute love. It's a vision of life as love itself. So it's pointing to this absolute nature, this absolute vision of life as love. Pointing to this, the notion of emptiness, a non-dual reality. So the different texts, some started with beginning with relative bodhicitta, and some started with absolute bodhicitta. So I thought, well, this is interesting, because one is starting with emptiness, and one is starting with, loving others and yourself. Right? So I thought, this is interesting, because I started, the last talk was on self-love, and now I'm coming back at it from the way of emptiness. So some take the approach that absolute bodhicitta or emptiness should be understood first. Togme Zampo, his version of Lojong takes that approach. The Dalai Lama takes that approach. that the emptiness should be understood first. Some, such as Panchen Lama, say that it depends on the personality. So it's a bit of a if you're more of an intellectual type, and you are I call it a deductive learner, then you might have to understand emptiness in order to be convinced that liberation is even possible, in order to even do the practice. If you're more inclined towards inductive or emotional, you're more emotional in the way that you learn, then you can begin with relative bodhicitta. It might be the most helpful. So that's how Panchen Lama approaches it. So here's what the Dalai Lama said. The main reason for understanding absolute bodhicitta or emptiness first is that if you understand the voidness of all phenomenon, particularly mind, and the natural purity of mind, then you are convinced that it is possible not only to attain liberation, to get rid of all disturbing emotions and attitudes of unawareness, but you are convinced that it's possible to achieve total freedom. Unless you are really convinced of that, you can't really put your full heart into the relative bodhicitta to actually work to achieve it. So that's where he's kind of coming at. So when I read that, I thought, well, maybe I should have done the emptiness talk last week. But, and then Pema Chodron, for example, begins with relative bodhicitta when she presents. And I think Trungpa Rinpoche does as well. So you've got kind of three ways, and then the middle way, sort of a mixture. But I think the point of it is how interrelated they are. Whether you start with one or the other, how interrelated an understanding of emptiness is to self-love and expressing that love as compassion in the world. And that might not be something that's obvious to people, but I think it's crucial. So, I talked a lot about what self-love is, what radical self-acceptance is. I want to talk just a bit about what emptiness is. Because I've kind of put the term out there, and I've called it emptiness, voidness, absolute, bodhicitta, and so forth. But what actually is it? Because there's a lot of confusion about, or at least I come across confusion concerning the word sunatha or emptiness. It's actually voidness is maybe a better translation, but emptiness is what the word is most commonly used. And it's coming more from a Mahayana Tibetan teaching than it is from a Theravadan teaching. But I'm hearing more and more Vipassana or Theravada teachers talk about emptiness in their talks and in their writings. First, it's how does it differ from nothingness or non-existence? Some people think it means non-existence. It's not synonymous with non-existence. It's not a negation of anything. Actually, it's not saying something's not there. And any descriptions I give you of it are by their very nature dualistic. So although it's non-dualistic, any words I put out there are by definition dualistic. So it's in that way it's not really describable in language, even though I'm going to spend the next 15 minutes or so doing just that. The famous, it's the fingers pointing at the moon. Don't mistake all the words, which are the finger, for the moon. is when I first heard that many years ago, I just went, wow, I've been taking the finger for the moon. I've been, you know, looking at this finger thinking I'm going to figure out freedom by learning every aspect of the finger, the concepts and the words. And it was a revelation for me just to let those go, to sort of just let the words point. If I didn't understand something, well, it's just a finger pointing. Maybe this finger pointing will, you know, reveal something. And it was at that point that, you know, I could start to realize some of this. So emptiness transcends any description that I'm going to give it, but I'm going to do it anyway. So what is empty of what? We're talking about emptiness. Well, what is empty of what? It's the emptiness of the idea of a self, of all self definitions or self constructs that we project onto ourselves, to others, or onto objects. So it's empty of this idea of a self, of this illusion of a self. And it doesn't mean non-existence. So, you know, you can see solid objects here. So you could say they're existent. So it doesn't mean non-existent. It just means no independent existence. So on a relative level, everything exists interdependently. So people get that everything is conditioned, it's based on causes and conditions that things come together. So everything's interdependent. So take an apple. It's dependent on, you know, rain, sunshine, soil, and so forth. It's dependent on what's considered non-apple elements. And so an apple doesn't have its own nature, its own independent nature. It's dependent. If the conditions that an apple depends on were removed, there'd be no apple left over. So a cloud's not considered to be an apple, sunshine's not considered to be an apple, rain's not considered to be an apple. So what is it really? What is an apple really? It's a practical, valid description of what can conventionally, independently, but not ultimately, be established. So it's dependent. It's dependent on the other conditions, and we could say it's empty. It's empty of an inherent, independent existence. You could say that about anything. Everything that we see or sense as objects are dependent on other causes and conditions, whether they be objects we see, smell, taste, touch, hear. None of them exist independently. And we can say that about this body as well. So many people say, well, I can't see the emptiness of things perceived by the eye. So I perceive a bell. I don't see the emptiness. I just see a bell. And that doesn't change. You realize emptiness, it doesn't change. You still see a bell. And it still has a... If I strike it, it still makes the sense door of sound of hearing still receives the sound, even though you have realized either intellectually or in a felt sense or both That doesn't change. You still perceive it. So we're not refuting the appearance of things as solid. We're not refuting the appearance of what is seen, heard, touch, sense, and so forth. The issue, and the issue is that we cling to them as if they were real, ultimately real. This is what the Four Noble Truths point to, the Five Aggregates point to, that word clinging is the Dharma. I mean, who cares if things are empty otherwise, right? It could be some of you might think, well, who cares? I mean, it sounds like physics or something. But but the reason it's important is because it causes suffering. The illusion of things as having an essence and having the potential to cause, clinging to them, the grasping or pushing away, can bring us some satisfaction or easefulness in life is what is causing us suffering. So we're not refuting what's out there, what we see, hear, touch, and so forth. The issue is that we cling to them as if they're real. So the appearance of things doesn't cause suffering. What creates suffering is clinging to them as if they were real, that they're permanent sources of happiness and independent from the rest of life. So the clinging to them is what the issue is, clinging to them as if they were real. So we have to be careful here too as with this teaching that emptiness... applying emptiness on the relative level can turn into nihilism. The view that all values are unfounded, existence is senseless and useless, those kinds of nihilistic viewpoints. So we have to be careful that, hearing the teachings of emptiness don't shift into a nihilistic perspective. And many people go through this sense of I went through a sense of things appearing, a sense that things are meaningless would be the kind of a why bother, why get up, why participate if it's all empty. They find you go through that anyway, and that's where it's really helpful to have a teacher that you can communicate with, share that with and explore. So this is losing conduct in view. So we have the view of emptiness. Losing conduct in that view is, since things are empty, I don't have to worry about the conduct. You have to balance conduct and view as you move through the world. So as emptiness is really synonymous with non-dual or ultimate truth. You can really see them as synonymous. And it's not a state that it's not a state of being. I just love this name, Tricycle magazine. I just love the stuff that comes out in it. Ken MacLeod, who one of the Lojong books he actually translated, I forget which Gampo he did a translation of. So he's very familiar with Lojong. Some very powerful things that he says in this this short article. The pursuit of happiness for its own sake is a fool's errand. As a goal, it is frivolous and unrealistic. Frivolous because happiness is a transient state dependent on many conditions, and unrealistic because life is unpredictable and pain may arise at any time. So you could read that and think, ooh, I thought this was all about happiness. I read that paragraph, I thought, where is he going to go with this, right? And he's really going into emptiness with this. Take a moment and reflect on what are you really seeking in your practice. I mean, after you hear that paragraph, you're probably not going to say happiness. But maybe it is. I mean, maybe I meet a lot of people that especially, you know, when I teach mindfulness-based stress reduction, well, they want to get rid of stress. They came here to get rid of stress. So you wouldn't start an MBSR class reading that, right? Many people come to this practice because they want to be happy or they want to get rid of some emotional state that's arising for them, some physical pain that's arising for them. And it works in that regard. But as a spiritual, I mean, this is really a spiritual group, not a MBSR group. At a spiritual level, it's something else. So think about what you are seeking in your practice. Is it a kind of transcendence, a bliss, infinite light? And I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs here. Are you looking for an awareness so deep and powerful that your frustration and difficulties with life vanish in the presence of your understanding and wisdom?
Sounds good.
Are you looking for a ticket out of the messiness of life? So I think that's what many of us are looking for. So he goes on to say, if you think of freedom as a state, you are in effect looking for a kind of heaven. Instead, think of freedom as a way of experiencing life itself, a continuous flow in which you meet what arises in your experience, open to it, do what needs to be done the best to your ability, and then receive the result. That's beautiful. Receive the result. So instead of looking at it as a state, or emptiness as a state, think of freedom as a way of experiencing life itself, a continuous flow in which you meet what arises in your experience, you open to it, do what needs to be done to the best of your ability, and then receive the result. So that's what he's pointing to as, you know, what we an alternative way of looking at why we practice. And I'll read one more short paragraph. Life is tough, but when you see and accept what is actually happening, even if it is very difficult or painful, mind and body relax. There is an exquisite quality that comes from just experiencing what arises completely with no separation between awareness and experience. So emptiness is not a state either. In fact, it's the nature of all states. There's no boundary in emptiness to separate it from anything else. So you can't say it's a state. So it's synonymous with non-duality. it can be spoken in terms of nothing. So nothing is happening since there was no one for anything to happen to. So realizing that it's all a play of consciousness. Our experience of the world is all a play of consciousness. And when we all create our own world in our consciousness. When we go, that world dies with us. No two of us in this room have the same world. So nothing is happening and there's no one for anything to happen to. And it can also be spoken in terms of everything. So it can be spoken in terms of nothing and everything. In terms of everything, there is awareness. There are many manifestations of life. Life living as us. As there are expressions, or as expressions of love or energy, etc. We talk about expressions at the psychological level, the energetic level, the psychic level, the physical level, and so forth. These are all manifestations of emptiness or non-dual reality. So it's kind of the oneness that allows all things. And it's free of any essential nature. So one does not see emptiness when looking at objects. It's similar to looking in the mirror. You don't, we know that we're only seeing a reflection and not what's really there. So you can look at an object and know that it's empty nature, but also appreciate the appearance of that as an object. So in terms of practice, we're not moving towards emptiness or non-dual reality. It's not a goal to realize. It is the practice. Our practice arises from, our practice is a manifestation of emptiness, of non-dual reality. So the practice itself is the goal. As Krishnamurti said, the seeing is the doing. The practice itself is the goal. The ends and the means are the same. Emptiness is what you are. It's not an aspect of perception. It's not something you perceive. It's who you are. And the journey into emptiness is sometimes stated as Om Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Savaha. If you've heard that, maybe even chanted, Om Gate Paragate. I chanted that for years at Insight Meditation Society in Barrie. I actually didn't know what it. I never bothered to. Just I love chanting, so I would just chant away, and the vibrations. It's relaxing. It makes me feel good. So I chant away, and then eventually, figured I'd find out what the heck it meant. And it's actually a very, very profound. If people know the translation. Om stands for the one. So it's Om, one, transcending, gate, even transcending of transcending, suchness, so be it. So it's if you look at that, it's transcending even the transcending of transcending. So it's pointing to the emptiness of even the idea of emptiness. That's why the Buddha used that word, suchness.
Is that from the Diamond Sutra?
I don't know where it's from. I know what.
Yeah.
Does anybody know where that actually comes from?
Yeah. No, it's the Heart Sutra.
The Heart Sutra. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. So we can talk about having a mind that does not dwell anywhere. perhaps when you're meditating, you're allowing the mind to not dwell on any particular object, choiceless awareness perhaps, just dwelling in emptiness. We need to be careful not to dwell in not dwelling anywhere. It's wonderful, it's so relaxing to dwell in not dwelling anywhere. That Ajahn Chante retreats, I just dwell, sit there and dwell in non-dwelling, and you just kind of just open space. But that we have to be careful that's not the practice is not dwelling anywhere, not to dwell in enlightenment or delusion, clarity or confusion, form or emptiness, hope or fear. Not dwelling anywhere. Just letting, in other words, letting things be, letting whatever arise. So it's, if confusion arises, that's okay too. So it's not like, oh, I had this realization last month that, you know, all perceptions are empty. So I shouldn't be affected by perceptions. So a perception arises and you go, oh, triggered. Geez, I must not really have had that. That's just what's arising. Can you just be with that? Not dwell, think you have to dwell in any kind of way of being. There was a student came to, this is a story of a student who came to Zen teacher and said, tell me what the practice is that I need to do. I'm willing to just practice, you know, all the time and stay here. What's the practice? He goes, well, you go away and you come back when your mind is empty. Well, he went, and you know how hard that is, right? It took him a couple of years or more and just probably did lots of absorption meditation, right? Concentration. Came back and said, okay, I did it. My mind is empty. He goes, okay, now throw that away too. So it's not dwelling even in emptiness. Matt always says this, and one of Matt's pithy quotes, when we are truly free, there's no need to remind ourselves of that fact. So you don't have to go around reminding yourself, oh, I think I'm free. So that's a summary of what emptiness is. And I hope you get the idea that it doesn't mean non-existent, because that's the first thing, that's what a lot of people, you know, that that I'm speaking and with students will think, well, how's this, like, I exist, I see that, you know, I'm here and this is here. So it's not, this is not pointing to a negation of the appearance of things at a relative level. It's not negating that we, you know, there's just a body that's appearing at the relative level. There's perceptions arising. There's feeling, tone arising. Mental formations arising. And so forth. Just that nothing has an inherent existence, independent existence. Everything in the relative world is dependent, interdependent on something else. The Tibetans talk about emptiness, and I'll just go over their kind of three ways of speaking of emptiness. Emptiness as ground, emptiness as path, and emptiness as fruition. So the emptiness as ground, that refers to emptiness as egolessness or selflessness. that there's nowhere to stand in order to realize emptiness. There's no subject-object relationship. There's no ground from which we need to become a better self. There's no need for dogma or concepts of any kind. There's no struggle, no need to fight with existence. There's no ground or anything to work with. So that's emptiness as ground. Emptiness as path refers to a complete openness that allows for everything, including confusion. Allowing for everything, including confusion. First time I went into a teacher and talked about confusion that was arising at a meditation retreat, and the teacher said, "Can you just allow that confusion?" I thought, wow, I expected something different. I expected, you know, some pithy comment about why, you know, how to cut through the confusion, right? Like, you know, magistry with the sword and all this, maybe my personality coming out a bit, but it just, you know, wanting to overpower confusion. But, you know, just, can you just allow confusion? Just be open to confusion arising. That's what's arising in this moment. And that was quite, that was a real turning point for me, and that's what emptiness's path is pointing to. No judgment about what's arising. Absolutely fine. Because we know what the judgment, you know, we know judgment, clinging and so forth, how that causes suffering. We're willing to relate to whatever arises. And then this allows for, you know, within Lojong, allows for true compassion to arise. Because there's no difference between self and other. You're not doing anything, you're just being. So you're not doing anything for the other person. There's no self and other, you're just being life. That's where this, you know, this training in compassion is so powerful. Is it... dissolves the separation between self and other and allows compassion to arise from that container, from that place, as opposed to it being me being compassionate towards you. It's like, you know, I wouldn't, you know, cut off my left hand. You look at hurting somebody as that kind of an activity when there's no separation between self and other. Emptiness as fruition. There's no end goal in pursuing emptiness or freedom. Life keeps unfolding and we just remained present. We're not influenced by emotion or beliefs. There's total security because there's nothing to lose. We no longer relate to the idea of emptiness. We are emptiness. So this is where you'll just allow all these words that I just said are just ideas about emptiness. They're concepts. They're fingers pointing at the moon. Just allowing them. They're not needed anymore. I mean, they're perhaps needed at this point, but as emptiness as fruition, they're just... seen as empty. The views, emptiness of views, concepts, and so forth. We are emptiness. It's not an emptiness we think about. It's an emptiness from the point of view of its own dimension. Even the absence of a self, sense of self or ego is no longer felt or important. So that's building the foundation for Lojong. That's emptiness and self-love and how the two relate together. As I pointed to, self-love and or radical self-acceptance as being the foundation or a gate for the realization of freedom, and emptiness is another is part of that picture as well. What I'd like to do next time is really go into detail about the different aspects of emptiness. And that's really what Lojong, it starts out. So I'm going to start with absolute bodhicitta and really talk about the different aspects of emptiness. So are there any questions about that talk or anything else that's come up in your practice or daily life in terms of the Dharma? Yeah.
When you're posting your talk on the website, can you post the books that you're referencing during the talk so you can take a look at?
Oh, okay.
Just the name of it. Because as you said, you have six of the books yourself, and I can't quite see what you cover.
Okay, well, yeah, come up and take a look. But there are many, for sure, yeah. If you just go into, even just go in. But I'll put up the ones I think are useful, because if you type in Lojong in, you know, one of the book sites, you will get, you know, a couple dozen. Some are easier to understand than others. But sometimes the ones that are not easy to understand, actually, I found just spending some time with them, there's really some this deep nuanced meaning that can emerge from them as well. But I'll tend to put ones out there that are you know, easy to understand. As Norman Fisher's is a very, you know, it's written for a Western audience, put it that way, and uses language that we're used to. Yeah. So yeah, I can. I'll try and remember to do that. Yeah.
And practical question: the ultimate versus the relative. Is this something that all forms of Buddhism address? Sort of like the Four Noble Truths. That I'm not really clear on that. That whole, you know, Mahayana, you know, various types of Theravada and Vipassana and all the things that you were referring to. I'm just curious as to whether what you're referring to here, relative versus ultimate bodhicitta, is something that all of these practices would have needed.
Okay. Yeah. No. The short answer is no, they don't all refer. It very much comes from the. I mean, you can divide it if grossly, but into Theravada and Mahayana and Tibetan or Vajrayana, Vajrayana Buddhism. And this would come more from the Tibetan, because the Tibetans really talk about bodhicitta and the bodhisattva much more. I mean, so did Mahayana, but it's definitely not something that would be covered in a Theravadan text, which is interesting, because but what I find in the West, and you know, Joseph Goldstein talks about this in the book One Dharma. These are all in the West. What's happening is they're coming together and merging into a really interesting soup of, and we're seeing that, you know, although there's some inconsistencies and some things that don't fit nicely together as teachings, they're all pointing to the same truth, so they all have utility in that regard, usefulness, and can help us realize the ultimate reality. But yeah, to answer your question, this Lojong comes from Tibetan teachings, and as does the absolute and relative bodhicitta. It's different words for the same, you know, emptiness. And I've talked many times about relative, conventional reality and ultimate reality, right? And this is where when people say, "Oh, there's a paradox in the teachings. Where the paradox usually comes from is where relative and ultimate realities are different planes, different dimensions or whatever. And so people say, well, how can these two, they just exist? Of course, ultimately, it's all empty, but you can look at it that way, and that's what that's pointing to. So it's a useful model.
The Theravadins would be referring to unconditioned versus conditioned, where you're saying emptiness. It sounds like a similar way of putting it.
The conditioned is the relative, as I said, what exists in the appearance of things to our senses is the relative world, reality, relative reality, and so it's all conditioned, right? It's nothing exists independently. The apple. It needs a condition, other conditions of light and water and so on to exist. So that's the conditioned reality. So realizing the unconditioned is realizing a reality that's beyond that reality, which would be the non-dual, the ultimate, the realizing emptiness. It's a different route to come at the same teaching, and all spiritual traditions actually talk about this. You can find it in the mystical streams of not just Theravada and Mahayana, but in Christian, Sufi, and so forth. There's the same discussion. About conditioned, unconditioned, empty, and so forth. Yeah, it's so amazing that the stuff, different centuries, completely different people, they're saying the same things from an intellectual point of view. I mean, my mind says, well, there's got to be something to this if so many people are saying it, right? Yeah. So, to answer your question, it's the same. It's pointing to the same thing.
I found myself thinking, as I was listening to your talk, and thinking about my own practice. I wonder how much of our mind, but I suppose our delusion, is language and so much of our experience of the mind is thinking. And it's in words. It's very strange, really, that we have this experience of somebody speaking to somebody, in our minds. And when that isn't happening, or when you do see it and its strangeness strikes you, its kind of artificiality strikes you, then there's room for such a broader kind of experience. It's so seductive, the stories that we tell, just a bunch of words. It's amazing how the power it can have over us. It almost seems like it's our kind of great blessing and our great curse at the same time, language, how it can allow us to use abstraction to make all kinds of extraordinary things. But abstraction from our own experience is causes suffering. So, I find that I guess when I started practice, I hoped that I would be able to stop thinking. But I think it's more that just experiencing the difference between thinking and not thinking. What's the quality of your experience when you're thinking about a difficult thing, a difficult emotion, say, and the quality of your experience when you are just being with it? It's very different, although it's, again, it's so easy to get seduced by those stories. But it's amazing, we don't even have to think about words. We just open our mouths, you know, they come. We're like fish swimming in words, you know.
As you pointed to the idea of being with, you know, the words or the thoughts. So it's not, you know, and as you pointed out as well, it's not trying to stop thoughts. It's our relationship to the thoughts that shifts. It's seeing the emptiness. And that's one of the levels that I'm going to talk about eventually, is the emptiness of concepts, thoughts, views. So it's, that shifts our relationship to this arising, this constant barrage of thoughts. I mean, I heard one teacher tell a story about actually it was Carol Blotter, one of Matt's retreat manager, who does, you know, manages all Matt's retreats, told a thing about an inner roommate. If you looked at your mind as a roommate, you wouldn't live with them. You know, after a couple of days, you'd kick them out, right? Because of the things they say. I mean, so you develop a bit of a sense of humor. Sometimes I just, you know, mind will come up with something and it'll just be, wow, that is just out there. I mean, that's really out there. And sometimes it's negative self-talk, like, oh, you're real, blah, 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 because you know, and it's like, you know, that's amazing what, you know, it's conditioning, right? It comes up for, you know, based on causes and conditions, but empty. So it's a relationship to the thoughts that change. Not that thoughts stop. That's, you know, that's probably the first thing that people that join into a meditation group are shocked about, because they thought this meant that, you know, they were going to be able to stop this thinking mind, and they might be able to have a little peace from it, right? And you tell them, well, it's not, you know, it's not about stopping thoughts. Because, well, what we resist persists. That's a slogan that you can just put in there and just remember. If you sit and try and resist thinking, what's going to happen? Lots of thinking. So that's why we talk about letting go, letting be, you know, that's so key to the practice. So that's the relationship that we have with the thoughts. Doesn't mean we don't practice concentration practice, on the other hand, right? But if thoughts arise during your concentration practice, can you just be with that? That's what's arising. It's not a problem. There's no problems with emptiness. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.